Thank you, and thank you to all the organizers for for inviting me. And I've heard some really interesting talks this week. So I'm going to talk about some invariants and some computations in knot theory. And at the end, I'll show you some computation, some recent computation that's a little different from the other things we've seen this week. So the principle focus of the talk is going to be on Riedemeister moves. I'll tell you what those are, and there's pre-existing work on upper bounds, but the work I'll talk about today is the first non-trivial lower bound. So I'll talk about that. That's the main topic. So quick introduction to what Riedemeister moves are. Knots are going to be closed curves in R3 for our purposes, and they're represented by diagrams like these, and the principal issue that arises is that different diagrams can represent the same knot. So you see here that these three different diagrams all represent the same trivial knot. And sometimes it's not so easy to look at a diagram and determine which knot it represents. So I'm not sure, depending on how much practice you've had, it may or may not be obvious that that third one is a trivial knot. But with some thought, you can probably figure out how to unravel it. But there's some examples, even with relatively few crossings, of unknot diagrams, which are maybe quite hard to recognize as being unknotted. This is one example that was presented in the 1930s by Gorich. He had a sequence of examples. And I'll be talking mostly about unknots today and just the issue of recognizing diagrams as the unknot. So two knots are said to be equivalent if you can deform one to another without leaving the class of embedded curves. That's called an isotopy. And the basic problem of knot theory is that you'd like to recognize which knot you're looking at. It's called the knot recognition problem. So back in 1926, Riedemeister and independently Alexander and Briggs at the same time proved that if you had two diagrams which were equivalent, if they represented the same curve in R3, then you could pass from one to another using only three moves. And these are called the type 1, type 2, and type 3 Riedemeister moves. So there's a finite sequence of these which will take you from one picture of a knot to another picture of a knot, no matter what the knot is. This isn't a very difficult result by today's standards, but in those days, I guess people had different standards of rigor. This took about 25 pages to prove in those days. It would be a couple of lines today, I think. Anyway, what was left open by this result was how many such moves are required. So the technique of proof gave absolutely no information on how many Riedemeister moves were required to connect two diagrams. It was purely an existence argument. So we can ask that question. If you have two diagrams, D and D prime, representing the same knot, how many moves do you need? How many of these Riedemeister moves do you need to move from D to D prime? And we'll call that the Riedemeister distance of the two diagrams. Okay, so let's look at the situation for the simplest cases. These are all the diagrams with up to two crossings. There's quite a few already. And I've connected them by edges if there's a Riedemeister move moving from one of these to the other. The blue edges represent the type 2 Riedemeister moves, and the red edges the type 1 Riedemeister moves. And you can construct a graph this way, where you take all diagrams of the unknot and connect them with edges if the a Rademeister moves, passing from one of these diagrams to another. And this is quite a complicated graph, even in this, for this very simple case of diagrams with up to two crossings. So what we'd like to know is how distorted is this graph? Or one way to ask that question, what's the most efficient way to untangle a diagram? So if you start with some diagram of the unknot, like this one, there's some sequence of Rademeister moves of various types that eventually lead you to this unknot. How bad can this shortest path to the trivial diagram be? Could it be that you start with something with n crossings and you have to go up to some diagram with many more crossings before you eventually simplify to the trivial diagram? Or maybe you can, without increasing too much, get down to the diagram. So this is the length of this path is what we'd like to get upper and lower bounds to. We'd like to know how efficiently you can untangle the curve. Well, let me jump to the punchline of today's talk. It turns out that there are lower bounds that are quadratic, and these are examples of that give quadratic lower bounds. So this is a picture of an unknot, which has 7n-1 crossings. But the number of Rademeister moves you need to transform it to the trivial diagram, the Rademeister distance to the trivial diagram, is at least 2n squared plus 3n-2. In fact, we can almost say exactly what it is. We can find an explicit sequence of Rademeister moves that has 2n squared plus 3n length, has this length, and we can show the length is no more than 2 less. But in particular, there's a quadratic lower bound here. So maybe I should just say a little bit more about this example. Why is this an unknot? Anybody see why this is an unknot? Maybe it looks knotted to you. But you see this sort of there's a sort of a bigon over here at the right here that you can unravel. You can just pass this upper band over this other band, and you'll cancel these two crossings. And then you can repeat that for the next one. Right. The twists at the top and the bottom are opposite. These are positive and these are negative. So these will unravel. These 2n-1 positives and most of these at the bottom here will unravel if you do one at a time. So how many? So that's the sort of n operations that are needed to unravel these top and bottom twists. And how many Rademeister moves does that take? Well, it's a type 2 Rademeister move to cancel one of these tugons. But you have to get this end of the tugon over to the top before you can cancel it. You have to get them together. And to do that, you have to cross these n strands. So you need n type 3 Rademeister moves. That sort of slides this vertex up to the top one to cancel it. So you can see you sort of need quadratically many to cancel here. And then once you cancel all but one of these, then it's fairly easy to see that the rest of it unravels. So I won't go through the details. But this is the example. But there's many potential examples. The real issue is how do you prove that there isn't some more efficient way than the way I pointed out? And this is a general problem in algorithms. When you want to get an upper bound, what you do is you describe some procedure to solve the problem, and then you analyze it, and that gives you an upper bound for the running time of an algorithm. But if you want to get a lower bound, it's not enough to analyze a particular procedure. You have to show there's no more efficient procedure. And that's I think, why lower bounds tend to be much rarer in complexity theory. So let me just take a minute to talk about upper bounds, although that's not our subject today. Upper bounds for this problem on how many Rademeister moves were needed were given by work I did with Jeff Ligarius about 8 or 9 years ago. And what we showed was that there's an exponential upper bound. So if you have a curve, if you have a diagram with n crossings, you need no more than c to the n Reitemeister moves to change it to the trivial diagram. C here was explicitly computed. We've got a rather large constant. But this can be improved. Probably the right constant should be something like 3. But it didn't matter much. The main point was that it was exponential. And this proof is based on a mathematical theory in three-manifold theory called normal surface theory. I won't talk about that today. But the main question is there a polynomial upper bound? It's still a reasonable guess. And this is sort of an important problem in knot theory. If there was a polynomial upper bound for the problem of determining whether two knots are the same, then there wouldn't be any real point in finding knot invariants, for example. There's a big industry where people find knot invariants. But if you could just look at a knot and in polynomial time determine whether two knots were the same, you wouldn't be aided in recognizing knots by computing invariants, because it generally takes polynomial time to compute an invariant. So there's no gain in understanding, in recognizing knots from invariants.
Well, the polynomial upper bound, you said that it is
empty, but not a key. I meant a polynomial upper bound for the recognition problem, which is a slightly different question. Yeah. You're right. A polynomial upper bound for the number of Reitemeister moves is a little different. It's weak. It's not equivalent to a polynomial running time for an algorithm. Yes?
Do you have any candidate diagrams that seem worse than quadratic?
You know, last week I would have said yes, but I'm not sure. I have some candidates that could be cubic, but now I'm suspecting that they're quadratic too. So I don't have. So there's two halves to this problem. One is to find some good candidate diagrams, and the second part is to find some method of showing that you can't do them efficiently. I should mention that the previous theorem was just for the unknot. This is for an unknot diagram. The proof is much harder for general knots. It was just given this year, actually. In work of Coward and Lackenby, they showed that the number of Reitemeister moves needed to pass between two n-crossing diagrams is bounded by some tower of exponentials. And this hasn't appeared in, I don't think it's appeared yet, but not even as a preprint, but I heard a talk on it. I forget how big the tower was. I think it was exponentially large. So the number of exponents here is exponential in n. So it's a very large number. Anyway, let's talk about lower bounds. So there's what I said before. There's problems. The problems with finding good lower bounds is that you can't just analyze a particular procedure. You have to find something more subtle to establish lower bounds of this sort. And even if you can prove somehow that your problem is at least as hard as some other problem, you can perhaps prove that it's NP hard. That doesn't prove, for example, that it's not polynomial or it doesn't have some particular simple solution, because we don't know that P is not equal to NP. So the way we actually establish lower bounds is we're going to define a new invariant. We're going to assign to every knot diagram, every picture of a knot in the plane, an integer invariant. And the motivation is to follow a general program for constructing invariants that was introduced by Arnold and Vasiliev. And these are today known as finite type invariants, these kinds of invariants. And this invariant G that I'll tell you about is a finite type invariant of order 1. So I'll spend a few minutes telling you what finite type invariants are as interpreted in this way. But this particular invariant that I'm going to introduce is very different. You may have seen some of the talks about the Jones polynomial and other invariants where one proves that they're not invariants by defining them and then showing that they don't change when you do a Riedemeister move. So they become invariants not of a diagram but of a knot. But what we want is something exactly the opposite. We want something that does change when you do a knot, Riedemeister move. So knot invariants are exactly the opposite of what we want. But we want something that changes in a controlled way. So if we just had something that we want to understand how something how some invariant changes when you perform a Riedemeister move. So it turns out this invariant will change by at most plus or minus one when a diagram changes by a Riedemeister move. So I'll tell you what the invariant is in a minute, but first let me just talk about general finite order invariants in this context. For defining a finite order invariant, we're going to define it not just on diagrams, which look like this before a Riedemeister move and this after a Riedemeister move. We'll also define this invariant on singular diagrams that occur on the transition. This is the codimension one strata of the space of diagrams, if you like. So there's one such type of singular diagram associated to each of the Riedemeister moves. And the rule we'll use for a finite order invariant is that the invariant on this left diagram minus the invariant on the right diagram will have value equal to the invariant on the singular diagram in the middle. So the value on a singular diagram with a single singularity is just the difference between these two nearby non-singular diagrams. And this singular diagram in the middle here, I've marked it with a minus here. That's because these two strands aren't really touching. One is underneath the other one. So I have to say which one of the two is underneath. And I've marked that with a minus sign. So that tells you on if you push it through, this the one on the left goes underneath. Okay, so this if I put the minus on the right, I'd get this guy underneath instead of on top. So a finite order invariant also is defined on these singular guys. Here's another example of a singular guy. This is a type 3 Riedemeister move where you pass the strand behind here from the bottom to the top. And in the middle here, we see the strand coinciding with this crossing. So there's a triple point in the projection. And again, the minus sign indicates that this strand runs behind the other two. And once again, the invariant on this singular diagram is the difference of the invariant on the diagram you start with and the invariant you on the diagram you order with. There's a issue with signs and so on, but I won't worry about that. Anyway, what's a type 1 invariant? So an invariant has order k. A finite type invariant has order k. What does that mean? In particular, the invariants I'm going to look at have order 1, which is the simplest interesting case. Well, the value for a finite order invariant, if it has order k, if a finite order invariant has order k, then its value is 0 on diagrams which have k or more singular, which have more than k singular points. So you might imagine doing two of these moves in two different locations so that you have two of these singular points in the diagram. If you have an order one, a type 1 invariant, an order 1 invariant, then it will be 0 if you see a diagram with two singular points. Maybe we should start by thinking about type 0 invariants. What's an invariant of order 0? Then the value of the invariant would be 0 on all diagrams with even one invariant. What do we usually call such an invariant? It's called a knot or link invariant, because it doesn't change on the Riedemeister moves. So all link invariants and knot invariants are contained in the type 0 case. The finite order diagram invariants of order 0 contain all the knot invariants, because they would exactly be the ones that are not changing on the Riedemeister moves. But we have invariants of type 1, So if you see two singular points, their value will be zero. What does that mean? Well, it means that you can determine their value just by looking. You can determine the change in value from here to here by not worrying about what the diagram is in the rest of the picture, but just worrying about what the knot type is on the rest of the picture. Because the invariant will not change. If you look at the rest of the picture, what I haven't drawn here, it will. If you have a type 1 invariant, it will not change when you do another Reitemeister move somewhere else. So it only depends on the link type, the knot type, away from this point. And that's what we're going to exploit to do our computations. So when Reitemeister moves are performed elsewhere, an order 1 invariant will not change. It's just an invariant of the link type at other points. So let me give the definition now. We want to define an invariant on the set of knot diagrams. It turns out you can define diagrams in the two-sphere instead of the plane. Doesn't really matter, but it's a little easier to set it up this way. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with a link invariant, an invariant of oriented two-component links. And the simplest such invariant is the linking number, so that's what we're going to use. So the linking number of two-component link is just you take a surface that bounds one of the components and you count how many times the other component pierces that surface. It's an old invariant, very simple to compute by lots of formulas. And that's what we're going to use. But we could have used anything else. We could have used, for example, the Jones polynomial for two-component links. That would have given us type 1 invariant as well. Anyway, we'll use this one, the linking number. And how do we define the invariant on a diagram? Well, first I want to define what I mean by a smoothing at a crossing. So here's a knot invariant, and I'm going to do a smoothing of this. Here's a knot diagram, and I've drawn an orientation just to show how the knot is passing around. You'll get the same answer with the other orientation, but it's convenient to choose one. So a smoothing is a way of cutting and pasting at a crossing to remove that crossing in such a way that the orientations are preserved. And when you do that to a knot, you'll always get a two-component link. And those two components may or may not link each other. In this example, they do link each other. They link each other once. Okay, so that's the idea for smoothing, and we're going to use smoothing to define this diagram invariant. So here's the actual definition of the invariant. You start with a diagram D. You divide its crossings into the positive crossings and the negative crossings. So in case you're not familiar with that, each of these crossings can be associated a sign, plus or minus. This one happens to be a minus sign. All three of these are minus signs. And so you can divide the crossings into positive and negative crossings. And what you do is associate to a diagram an element of a free abelian group with bases xi and yi. So you get one generator for each element of the integers. For the x family, there's two families of generators. So you can think of this as two Lorentz polynomials, if you like. And the invariant is simply a sum over each of the crossings. If it's a positive crossing, you take a generator x, subscripted by the linking number of the link you get by smoothing at that crossing. So, and similarly for y, for the negative crossing. So let me just show you an example. Here's a unknot with three crossings, 1, 2, 3. So let's look at this crossing. This is a negative crossing. And if we smoothed at this point, if we did the smoothing, we'd get a closed circle here, which has zero linking number with this other curve that you'd get if you smoothed here. So the linking number would be zero, and it's a negative, so that would give a y sub zero. You'd you'd take the generator Y, and the index would be 0, because the linking number of the resulting link would be 0. You always get linking number zeros when you smooth any of these, so you get one X from the positive crossing and two Y's from the negative crossing. Let me do another example. Before I do another example, it's more convenient to have an integer-valued expression, so we can just assign integers to each one of these variables, and a convenient formula turns out to be to assign x sub k, the integer 1 plus the absolute value of k, and y sub k to be minus 1 minus the absolute value of k, and then we'll get an integer-valued invariant. So in this case, this was x sub 0 plus 2 y sub 0, so that's assigned 1 minus 2, and the integer invariant is minus 1. Let's do another example. This diagram has three crossings, each of them is negative. So when you smooth one of these crossings, you get this link with two components. The linking number is minus 1. And by the symmetry, you can see the same thing happens at either of the other two crossings. So it's a negative crossing, so it gets a y assigned to it, and the linking number was minus 1, so the variable is y minus 1, and there's three of them. When you assign an integer invariant to this rather than an element of this free abelian group, then we get this formula for g said y minus 1 was assigned an integer minus 2, and there's three of them, so we get minus 6 to be the value of this diagram. So that's an invariant of a diagram. And to show it's useful, what we want to do is to show that it changes nicely on the Rademeister moves. So this is the part of the procedure that's quite tricky to arrange, and these definitions were chosen to make this true. So let me just indicate how that goes. How does this invariant change under a Rademeister move of type 1? So we start with some diagram that has a little strand here, and we could compute this invariant. We'll get some answer in this free abelian group. Or we could instead first do a Rademeister move, so then we've introduced a new crossing right there, and then we could compute this invariant. Well, we get exactly the same answer at all other crossings. So the only thing that would change would be there'd be one new term coming from this crossing, and that new term would be gotten by smoothing this crossing and computing the linking number of the link you get. Well, this link has linking number 0, so depending on whether this was a plus or minus crossing, you'd either get an x0 or y0 from this type 1 Rademeister move. So the change in this invariant would amount to either an x0 or y0, and with this formula for integer values for each variable, we see that the change in this invariant G is just either 1 or minus 1. So this is the property we want. It changes not too much under a Rademeister move. You can look at another type of Rademeister move. In this case, this is our original diagram. We've introduced a Rademeister move of this type, and it has two new crossings. So there's two new terms in this invariant, one that comes from smoothing this crossing, and one that comes from smoothing that crossing. So these two new terms, one of them is a plus crossing and one is a minus crossing. The linking number of these two links, it's hard to say what it is, but it's the same in both cases because these are isotopic curves. So we get an xn plus a yn. And when you look at this formula for g, you'll see that the xn produces 1 plus n and the gn produces minus 1 minus n. So this doesn't change under this kind of move at all. G remains the same. There's an orientation chosen here, and let me just look at one more case. If the orientation is opposite instead of in agreement here, then you do the same thing, and again you get two new crossings contributing terms, but this time this time you get, well, no, this is the set. I got these backwards. This is the case of different, I mixed these up. This is the case where you get two different links, actually. These two guys differ by a crossing. But the links just change, the linking number just changes by one between them. So, anyway, the slide is wrong, but the computation is correct. And in each case, you get just a change of plus or minus one at most in this invariant. And in the Reitemeister-Move case, the argument is considerably more complicated. You go from here to here. There's three terms in each case, three smoothings in each case, and you have to sum them up, and you see that in each case, the difference is at most plus or minus one for the invariant G. So let me show the first example where you get an interesting application. If we look at these two diagrams, both of them are unknot diagrams. It's fairly easy to see that these are unknots. You just unravel this middle bigon first, and then in turn you can cancel everything else out. These both have 2n plus 1 crossings. They have the same winding numbers around every region in the plane. They have their writhes, is another diagram invariant, differs by 2. All their annulled invariants are the same because they actually have the same projection to the plane. So those of you who don't know about these things, the annulled defines some invariants of plane curves, finite type invariants of plane curves, and one might hope that you could use those for purposes like this, but it turns out they don't give interesting information about diagrams. So all the previously known invariants only showed that you needed at least two Reitemeister moves to pass from one of these diagrams to the other. So these diagrams were chosen to have closely matching invariants for everything that was known to give bounds on Reitemeister moves previous to these new invariants. And using these new invariants, you can compute these values, and you see that the difference in this invariant G is 2n plus 2, which means you need at least 2n plus 2 Reitemeister moves to go from one to the other. And in fact, you can realize 2n plus 2 by just doing the obvious thing of unraveling one and re-raveling it on the other one. So this gives a proof of what otherwise isn't so easy to see, that there's no simple way to connect no simpler way to connect these two than the obvious one. So let me say a little bit about this one. In this one, the computation is a little more tricky, but if you compute the invariant on this curve, on this diagram, it turns out to be 2n squared plus 3n minus 2. And that shows that you need at least this many Reitemeister moves to pass from this diagram to the trivial knot. So I could show you some computations, but they wouldn't be particularly illuminating. Let me tell you what the main open questions I think in this sort of area are now. The first one is, are there polynomial upper bounds on the number of Reitemeister moves needed to connect two diagrams? And this is fairly plausible. There's some heuristic arguments that indicate this might be true, but certainly not known. Is there a polynomial time algorithm to recognize what knot you're looking at? I think this is perhaps the most important problem in knot theory, in my opinion. And are there examples with cubic or higher lower bounds on the number of Reitemeister moves? Okay, so that ends what I wanted to say about Reitemeister moves. I want to show you some computations now in a slightly different direction. I want to talk about some work with Chaim Rubenstein and Abigail Thompson that's very recent that concerns some other invariants, this time invariants of knots and curves in three space that are motivated by some biology considerations. So, in biology, one of the things, one of the methods that's used to examine DNA and to determine which, what the structure is of a piece of DNA is a method called gel electrophoresis, in which a bunch of DNA is given an electric charge and then it's pulled through a gel by an electric field. And the speed of motion tells you things like if it's a strand, if it's an arc, how long that strand is. That's proportional, or that's a function of the speed through the gel is a function of its length. Shorter things move faster. And biologists have also created circular DNA and done experiments with that that seems to indicate that the crossing member has the crossing number of a knot, the number of crossings in a projection, is related somehow to its motion through a gel. So we try to create some mathematical theory of what might regulate the motion of a closed curve through a liquid or gel, so through some physical medium. So the kind of there's different models for what a gel is, but the standard idea seems to be that these gels are pretty fibrous, so you should think of them as having little rods, little fibers in them, that the knot hangs up, that a curve hangs up on is has to move around as it progresses down. Now, if you have some sort of curve, its motion through such a medium is going to be determined by its geometry, not by topology. But it's reasonable to assume that the curve will assume some minimal energy configuration. And in that configuration, it's plausible that some topological properties are reflected. So as the loop moves, we'd like to know what sort of properties affect its intersections with vertical planes. So we did some computations of a different nature than the other ones you've seen these weeks. We did some analog computations rather than digital computations. This was done in an undergraduate research seminar that was run by Abby Thompson. So what we did was, after much experimentation with various mediums like dropping wires through water and beads through oil and so on, what we settled down on was we got these jars. These are about 2 feet tall. You're seeing them from the top here. And these knotted curves were made, these closed curves were made from spaghetti, which has been soaked in water for about an hour. So it's nice and flexible. And then you can twirl the two ends together. And it turned out that it takes about half an hour for a strand of spaghetti to drop from the top to the bottom of this vessel. So then we did some experiments with different configurations. So this is a figure eight knot, and this is an unknot. And
what was the liquid in there?
The liquid was shampoo, it turned out. So, yeah, I can give you more details later. So then we did and you can see that the trefoil is falling faster than the unknot. The unknot has unraveled, and this is the same result that the biologists see in their experiments. Actually, the biological experiments are quite mysterious, although they have a lot of claims in their papers. They claim, for example, that the velocity is proportional to the average crossing number, and so on. But in fact, their experiments switch the winners depending on how strong the electric fields are. So at low electric fields, the high crossing knots fall faster. At high electric fields, it changes, and the high crossing knots fall slower. So we haven't seen that kind of phenomenon in the shampoo. So let me show you some others. Here's the unknot versus trefoil. You see the trefoil. It took about, it takes close to half an hour for it to fall that far. Finally, the trefoil hit the bottom. The trefoil and the granny knot. Closer this time.
The length was the same?
The length is the same, yes. So this was part of the first series of experiments in this area was just to find the right medium to work in, and I think this one there were a lot of unsuccessful attempts with other things. This seems to be quite consistent and give the right kind of time scale, but we don't yet have results on timing, and we can't yet tell how the crossing numbers and length and so on affect the rate of falling, but that's part of the next project for this seminar. So there is actually some mathematics associated to this, so let me just talk about that for a few minutes. So biologists have claimed experimentally that the motion through gel is related to either crossing number or average crossing number, although that's just at low electric fields that's claimed to be true. So our goal was, can we develop some knot invariants that maybe more accurately would be designed to indicate how a closed curve would move through a fibrous material? So we want invariants that somehow capture how a closed curve in R3 intersects vertical planes. So a fiber to find some sort of vertical plane that lies above it was the idea. Although if the curve is rotating as it falls, which is often the case with DNA, then it may be that the motion is better modeled not just by intersecting with vertical planes, but by all planes in R3. So there's quite an interesting invariant that came out of this that I want to tell you about. So it's a generalization of the classical invariant, which is called the bridge number. So the bridge number of a knot is gotten by counting the number of critical points for a height function. So in this case, there's six critical points, three maximum, three minimum. Usually the bridge number just counts the maxima. So the bridge number of this curve would be 3 in the vertical direction. It becomes a knot invariant if you minimize it among all representatives of the knot. So this is one of the classical knot invariants that was introduced in the 50s by Schubert and studied extensively since then. But you can think of this in a slightly different way. Rather than counting critical points, what you can do is think of planes in R3 that are transverse to the knot, horizontal planes, and just count how many there are between critical points. And you get more or less the same thing. But from the second point of view, you're counting equivalence classes of horizontal planes where two are equivalent if they don't pass through a critical point. From this point of view, there's no need to restrict yourself to horizontal planes. So you can think about planes that aren't transverse, aren't horizontal. You can think of all the planes that are, say, perpendicular to the screen here. That's a two-dimensional family of planes instead of the one-dimensional family that we have on the left. And you can say, let's suppose we divide these into equivalence classes where two are equivalent if you can pass from one to the other without ever being tangent to the curve. So you get a finite number of equivalence classes, and that we'll call the two-bridge number of this knot. And you can also get slightly more information by summing the number of intersection points of each of the planes in an one for each equivalence class. That's called the two-width. So these are new knot invariants that haven't been discovered before. And you can increase this beyond 2. So with k equals 1, you get the classical bridge number. You take the set of planes in R3 parallel to the xy plane and divide it into equivalence classes by looking at the transverse planes to the curve. So the one bridge number is just essentially the number of path components in this set of transverse planes, the number of components. And you can do the same thing for higher dimensional families. You can look at the planes parallel to the z-axis. That's what we looked at a minute ago. You can look at all the planes in R3. That's a three-dimensional family. Or you can look at all the planes in round two spheres in R3. That's a four-dimensional family. And you can take the planes in one space that is to a curve and divide it up into equivalence classes, where two are equivalent if they're in the same path component. And then the K-bridge number would just be the number of path components. So here's a sort of illustration. For B4, you see a bunch of planes and the spheres here. I've only drawn the intersection with the plane of these planes and spheres. And things of the same color are in the same equivalence class. So the curve is this blue curve here in the background. And for example, these two brown curves are equivalent because you can pass from one to the other while always staying transverse to this blue curve. And similarly, this brown circle here is equivalent to this line because you can enlarge this circle until eventually its radius becomes infinite and it coincides with this line while keeping it transverse to the curve. But you get two new circles here that aren't equivalent to lines. Yes? Well, I haven't defined it. You can define S5 if you like. There are ways to go to higher dimensions. You can use quartics or cubics or something, yeah. You could define higher dimensional families. The four-bridge number is already pretty interesting because it gives a conformal invariant of the curve, since conformal maps preserve all these numbers. Anyway, we do have a few results about these invariants. For example, we know that for the two-width or the two-bridge number, only finitely many knots in R3 have two-width less than any number. So this is different from the bridge number. There's infinitely many bridge knots that have one bridge number, the classical bridge number, less than 3, say. But if you take a number like 100, there's only a finite number of knots that have two-width less than 100. And we're unable to prove this as yet for k equals 3 or k equals 4. You'd think it'd become easier as you go up, but it doesn't for various reasons. So this is actually quite hard to prove. Yes? Yes, that's right. So you have large numbers of non-equivalent planes when you measure two-width. But when you go to this three-dimensional family, there's an additional way to deform them, and they might become equivalent. So you're picking up new ones, but you may be losing old ones, and it's quite subtle to work out. Although I certainly expect it's true. We've managed to classify, to compute these for certain families, for example, for 2n torus knots and for knots of small width. And finally, there's some theorems of the Milner-Ferry type where you can relate. Ferry and Milner had a theorem that related the one bridge number to the total curvature of a curve in R3. And there are similar types of theorems here. For example, you can show that if you have a curve that has large such that every projection to a plane, a two-dimensional plane, has total curvature larger than K1, then the bridge number and the two bridge number and the two widths are not too small. So conversely, if you have something with small two bridge number, then its projection to some plane has small curvature. That's another way of saying that. So anyway, that's all I had for today. Thank you.